This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I want to thank the organizers of the event for inviting me, especially Aaron Levy, who has been remarkably helpful. To me, this gathering, as soon as I heard about it, seemed like a meaningful event. I think it is wonderfully responsive and sensitive that scholars and others should come together to celebrate this remarkable body of writings by Bill Anastasi, this vast web of thought which was composed on a scholarly theme by an artist. I imagine the reason that I was asked to speak first is that I have a pretty long history with Bill and with the work that he has done on James Joyce, Alfred Jarry, and Marcel Duchamp. In 1989, Bill and I made a little book together, which contained, though it was a little book, it contained a long text called A Conversation between William Anastasi and Thomas McEvely. What we did is we got together at a place in the country in Pennsylvania, and for 3 days we spent the afternoons sitting in front of a tape recorder and chatting about his work while we leafed through the pictures of it. Then I transcribed it and edited it, and I think it still remains the principal text in print about Bill's work. Then some years later, I wrote an essay for the catalog of his retrospective in Copenhagen, and then again later something for a print magazine about his print works. But meanwhile, while we were attending to these publications about his artwork, something else was going on. A couple of years after the first piece, The Conversation, Bill began working on a philological analysis of texts by Duchamp and Jarry. This was not simply a philological analysis, for it had a specific agenda. The physicist John Wheeler once, when asked what he was looking for in certain research, said, "Why, whatever I would find, of course." But Bill's search was different. He was looking for something in particular. He was looking for reasons to think Duchamp's writings may contain concealed references to Jarry's writings. As he himself put it, "I put forth evidence supporting my belief." So it almost sounds as if the belief came first and the evidence came later. This essay by Bill came out in the September 1991 issue of Art Forum under the title Duchamp on the Jarry Road. Bill then continued to work on related lines of thought about Duchamp, Jarry, and Joyce, and produced 6 other texts, 5 essays, and 1 interview over a period of about 15 years. These were remarkable pieces of thought and writing, and they have had a slowly growing readership that has culminated, so far anyway, in this event today. But there's more again. It's not just a question of readership. Since 2 of these texts have been exhibited as visual objects at the Sandra Guerin Gallery in New York City in 1995, and then more recently here at the Slot Foundation. The first of these texts is the first essay dealing with the secret presence of Jarry in James Joyce's work. Anastasi, in other words, has presented the manuscript, pardon me. The first of these texts was the first essay dealing with the secret presence of Jarry in Duchamp's work. The second was a later text that deals with the secret presence of Jarry in James Joyce's work. Anastasi, in other words, has presented the manuscript of his comparative text as a work of art, and specifically, judging from the manner and places in which it is exhibited, as a work of visual art. I'm going to talk about the two aspects of these events or exhibitions, first the aspect as art, and then the aspect as scholarship. Bill is the kind of artist for whom theory itself is a material from which he makes his works. As a youngster, he inherited the 18th century aesthetic theory of art, which held until around the mid-20th century. This theory was based ultimately on Aristotle's idea that human nature breaks down into three faculties, the cognitive, the ethical, and the aesthetic. In Kant's version of this doctrine, the faculties were mostly separated from one another on the model of the five senses, which do not intrude into one another's domains. This separation meant that each faculty takes care of its own aspect of reality. Thus, since, as Kant saw it, the experience of art is basically an aesthetic experience, there is no faculty except the aesthetic faculty that is relevant to it. Thus, the cognitive and the ethical faculties were both excluded from the experience of art. This was one of the central pillars of modernism, and is also one of the central tenets that postmodernism has attempted to seriously revise. To put it differently, the postmodern project was to expand the art discourse so all three faculties would have a part in it. Being very brief about it, I'll say the outcome was the appearance of two new genres of art, which in the crucial decade, 1965 to 75, were basically anti-aesthetic as they tried to promote the previously neglected faculties. These were conceptual art and performance art. Now being ultra brief, conceptual art championed the cognitive faculty, and performance art championed the ethical faculty. The aesthetic faculty was for a while in eclipse, or on leave, as Arthur Danto once expressed it, till the mix started to balance out in the late 70s and after. At first, it seemed heretical to many to think that there could be a cognitive art, an art that was cognitively based rather than aesthetically based. But in fact, seen in a larger view, this idea has been taken for granted in cognitive disciplines such as science and mathematics since the time of Pythagoras. I'm sure we're all familiar with the fact that many modern scientists and mathematicians have said that they felt that the material that they work with has an essentially artistic kind of energy and structure embedded in it, and that they see that aspect of their work as overlapping significantly with the aspect that we call art. Duchamp was the first artist to explicitly and completely devote himself to a cognitively based art comparable to that which was remarked on by scientists and mathematicians. It was like a declaration of secession when Duchamp said that he wanted to put art back into the service of the mind, that is, of cognition, and that he didn't want to be stupid as a painter, meaning that in the aesthetic era, painters, by rejecting cognition, had chosen to be stupid. He proceeded in a number of ways to put the idea into action. We all know what they are: mechanical drawing, the introduction of language into the work, and in the ready-mades, the presentation of a thing just as itself, a thing that declared itself to be itself and nothing more, a thing onto which no projections of aesthetic or religious values could effectively be made. This theme, which has been called tautology, became basic to conceptual art in its day, and Bill's own work must be seen as continuing and extending and ramifying Duchamp's project of making art cognitive, and, furthermore, doing so by following much the same elementary path that Duchamp had followed. Rather than extrapolate and ramify and exfoliate ornate and complex chains of cognition in some way that might be understood as cognitively artistic, Anastasi, like Duchamp, emphasized the pure primal concentration of cognition that is suggested by Aristotle's idea of the thought that thinks itself, cognitive consciousness in and by itself, autonomous to the point where it involves no object, nothing outside itself, a tautology. I will mention four pieces of Bill's work to illustrate this. On the easel here, we didn't have a slide of this piece, so a little photograph of it is erected on the easel. That is a 1963 piece called Microphone, in which a tape recorder plays back a loop on which the sound of its own mechanism has been recorded, creating a counterpoint with the living sound as it plays. I think this was the first piece of conceptual art that perfectly illustrated the theme of tautology or solipsism, the consciousness that is conscious only of itself. And secondly, this piece, which is colloquially known as the wall on the wall, and actually it is a detail of a work called Six Sights of 1966, in which each of the six walls of the Virginia Dwan Gallery in New York City had hung upon it a silk screen of itself at about 90% scale. So if you listen to the tape recorder, you hear the tape recorder. If you look at the wall, you see the wall. That's all there is. Everything is exactly itself and nothing more. And thirdly, this piece, which Bill and I have just decided the other night that its title should contain the word statue. Its title is Statue of a Tube of Titanium White, 1979. In this somewhat Baroque variation, the act of representation represents the representational material. Representation, in a sense, represents itself. At the same time, painting is elided into sculpture as representation is confounded with presence, another classical conceptual theme. The presence, however, is elusive, as it is the presence of a trick or illusion. It's the presence of a representation which is represented. Finally, I will mention a performance concept of Bill's from the 1960s, which I believe has never actually been realized. Two people are on the stage, one holding a measuring tape, the other a stopwatch. The measurer of space begins to measure a dimension of the stage. The measurer of time begins his measuring activity, clicking on the stopwatch. When the space measurer finishes and calls out, say, 13 feet 6 inches, the time measurer stops the stopwatch and calls out 1 minute 13 seconds. Measuring itself is measured. By the way, to employ one of Bill's own scholarly tropes, I wonder if this piece was derived somehow from a passage in Jarry where he says, "To explore the universe by seeking knowledge of points in space can be accomplished only through time. And in order to measure time quantitatively, we refer to space intervals on the dial of a chronometer. The basic theme of these and many other Anastasi works is tautology, or self-sameness, or self-reference, or the rejection of representation. It is the primal stage of consciousness, as in the thought that thinks itself. The subject is cognition at its most elementary and essential and stripped down. After about 30 years, in other words, of making art that isolated cognition and pointed at it with startling clarity from a number of directions, Anastasi began to write scholarly essays, which he then proceeded to display as art. In a way, I think he took permission for this from Duchamp's act of declaring that the notes in the green box were a part of the large glass. But in Bill's case, there was no supposedly primary physical artwork of which the manuscript was declared to be a part. So how does it work? Well, one way it might work is this. We've seen, or I've mentioned, that many scientists have regarded science as having an artistic quality. Science and scholarship, of course, are part of the same category in that both are based on the scientific method. If there is what might be called an aesthetic or artistic presence in science, is there similarly one in scholarship? Does scholarship also participate in the aesthetics of thought, or the type of cognitive presence that might be regarded as experienced as an analog to the aesthetic experience? And how could you tell? On the one hand, the question might have to do with the type of material to which the scientific method is being applied. Mathematics is a notoriously aesthetics-like presence, as demonstrated from the mathematics-like conundra of Zeno of Elea, down to the works of Gödel and others in modern times. The aesthetic or aesthetics-like presence of mathematics is often described as analogous to that of certain forms of music, as in the famous popularizing book of perhaps 20 years ago called Gödel, Escher, Bach. But that title also assumes a visual correlate in the implications of infinite regresses and inner contradictions in the works of Escher. Does scholarship have the same or similar tropes and formal thematics? In particular, the type of scholarship that Anastasi has been practicing in these seven texts is what is called philology, which consists of the analysis of texts and their comparison with one another in an attempt to arrive at conclusions about their original forms and purposes. What, if any, innate qualities does philology have that might compare to Bachian, Escherian artiness, or perhaps some other type of art-likeness? Perhaps the art-like resonances of philology are similar to those that Rudolf Carnap and others have seen in philosophy. Carnap's suggestion that philosophical arguments have an essentially aesthetic type of appeal seems also to be based on the analogy with music and on implications of infinity theory, as in Zeno's paradoxes. The rhythmical recurrence of themes and motifs in the prolonged argumentation of the ancient philosopher Sextus Empiricus, for example, may be seen as not unlike the recurrences of leitmotifs in Wagner. An argument in ordinary language philosophy may have a down-to-earth sense like a still life or a landscape on a manageable scale, and so on. But in general, such comparisons are based on music rather than the visual arts, perhaps because both music and text reveal themselves through an unfolding in time rather than in space. Anastasi's classic visual works, such as The Wall on the Wall, suggest rather a comparison with minimal music. Philip Glass, for example, once remarked to me that a very repetitive and uninflected work of his, which we had just heard, related to what American Buddhists of that time called the void doctrine. Indeed, there is a statement about mere and absolute self-sameness in such work with its relentless repetition, along with a lack of detailed articulation and emotional nuance, and wall on the wall could be described with similar terms. But there's another aspect of the comparison. Now, to return to the point where we began. In 1995, when Anasazi exhibited two texts in the Sandra Guerin Gallery in New York City. One was the text he calls Me, Inner Man, Monophone, which is based on or derived from his essay Jarry in Joyce of 1995. The second text pinned up on the walls was a version of the essay Du Jarry, a later development of Duchamp on the Jarry Road, in which traces of Jarry are sought and claimed to be found in the writings of Duchamp. Here the situation becomes ambiguous because of the physical surface of the manuscript, in which, for convenience, Bill encoded his quotes from the various authors in different colored inks. A heliotope red is Jarry. Joyce is green. Duchamp is black. Bill's own connective observations and so on are blue. The intent, I think, was not to be symbolic, yet I do feel an elementary symbolism at work. Heliotrope Jarry is the wild, flamboyant imagination. Green Joyce is Irish and also a kind of a child of nature. Black ink reveals Duchamp as just plain fact. And the blue of Bill's own pen was that of a schoolboy assiduously doing his homework. So the question has to arise. Did he exhibit the pages of these manuscripts like pictures on the wall because they are, in fact, pictures with different colors, compositions, and so on? Bill declared, when I asked him about the colors, that they were, quote, not for decorative purpose, but purely functional. Yet I doubt if he would have exhibited a printout like pictures on the wall. A printout would not only lack the aesthetic qualities of color, rhythmic recurrence, and complexity of structure, it would also lack the presence of the touch that is treated so reverentially in the formalist tradition, like the touch of a saint on a relic. It seems that sensual or aesthetic qualities are being invoked by this mode of exhibiting the text, and also that traditional religio-aesthetic ideas like the holy touch are creeping back in. I think the reason they are creeping in is because these texts are as close as Bill has gotten in the time I've known him to devotional religious practice. At the very least, he has produced a unique and highly personal new vision of the avant-garde of the last century, from Jarry in the 90s to Cage in the 90s. This would seem to be the lineage in which Bill feels his own work to belong, so there might be a bit of ancestor worship involved. But I'm going to suggest now that such a reductivist approach is too simple. Something at least as complex as three-voiced polyphony is going on among the voices of Jarry, Duchamp, Joyce, and Anastasi, maybe four-part. In these texts occurs the continual flowing repetition and modulation and variation and re-repetition of motifs as moments of attention are directed back and forth from one voice to another. And in the pictures, so to call them, the same rhythmic interplay and recurrence is seen as the colors come and go and return and recombine like voices in a polyphonic structure. So I am finally wondering if the content of the text is not carried strongly enough by the image flow of the picture aspect to render the two aspects one work appearing in two forms or modalities. Now let's turn from the artistic aspect of the exhibited pages to a scholarly type of question that is more purely cognitive. Is Anastasi right, in a factual sense, about the complex set of interconnections he has hypothesized among the oeuvres of Jarry, Joyce, and Duchamp, and secondarily Cage? For Cage comes into the pataphysical society a generation later, and as a symbol of a kind of historical closure, in a way, after the main troika of interconnections had taken hold. Amateur scholarship has had high moments, of which the great analogy to what Bill has done was the Second World War codebreaker Michael Ventris's decipherment of Linear B, the Bronze Age form of in which the Greek language was written in Mycenaean culture. But then the question arises, would we still honor the memory of Michael Ventris if his proposed decipherment had turned out to be wrong? From one point of view, its whole value would have changed. In relation to Anastasi's theories about Jarry, Duchamp, and Joyce, and the hidden references by the latter two to the former and to each other, there are two types of attack which this complexly and carefully wrought network of argumentation invites. The first is the question whether he is right, going detail by detail in the claimed echoes and references he has written about. Are they really there in the conventional sense that they were to some degree intended by the subjects, or are they figments of his devotion to three artists whose work seems to have been formative on his own? So one ends up looking through his arguments, searching among the many detailed comparisons for a smoking gun, a connection that cannot reasonably be denied, or hopefully more than one. I read all the essays over again the other day, and I think, as I thought when we did something like this years ago, Bill, that a pretty good smoking gun is the image of having sex through a pane of glass, which then breaks, which is shared by Jarry and Duchamp. And, of course, Duchamp's use of Jarry's word merdre is pretty ironclad. In addition to a few positives, one must also consider the accumulated weight of many plausible instances. I, for example, found no detail of comparable weight in the arguments about Duchamp and Joyce's character Shem in Finnegan's Wake. So a vaguer sense of rightness or probability will have to do. So much for the matter of the truth of details, which I'm not going to directly engage. Now, even if one agreed that Duchamp and Joyce both picked details out of their memories of Jarry's writings and obliquely brushed by them in their own texts, the question remains whether this amounts to a demonstration that these later authors used Jarry's texts as the armature or basis or general outline, all terms that Bill has used, of their own works. In other words, the many slight correspondences that Bill has gathered, even if some of them are individually correct, may just be a part of what Linda Henderson, speaking of Duchamp, calls his smorgasbord of references to many sources. Bill himself comments on the complexity of Joycean references especially. Do the arguments account in a way for some details in Duchamp and Joyce's smorgasbords of references, but still fail to explain the major themes or structures or intentions behind their oeuvres, which may perhaps be more powerfully accounted for in other ways? Or, if it should happen as we pick through the details of Bill's extensive argumentation, if it should happen that Bill's hypotheses are all untestable, then his general model will hang in the air as a living web of thought that waits tantalizingly for a resolution that may never come. I'm going to leave that aspect of our subject matter to the speakers who come after me. Or anyway, I'm going to leave it hanging here in the air for them to interact with or not as they like. Thank you. Of course, if nobody asks a question, then it means that I've succeeded totally in answering all questions. Yes. Going back, I'm sorry? Yeah. The pun that was supposed to go along with every ready-made. Yeah. I knew someone would bring that up. I know, that does complexify it a little. And so perhaps that means that I overstated it when I said that it is a thing which is just itself and nothing else, onto which no projections of aesthetic or religious values could be cast. I still think that is primarily true. I don't find that the puns that Duchamp attached to the ready-mades explain them in any way, nor do they put them in a particular context of interpretation, which would invite certain projections or others, depending on what context the location was in. I would look on that aspect of the ready-mades as combining two of Duchamp's strategies for returning art into the service of the mind. That is to say, there is, first of all, the pure tautology of the snow shovel or whatever that is just itself and doesn't refer to anything outside itself. And then there is also the linguistic pun, which involves his other technique that I mentioned in my little list, of introducing language into the center of the artwork. Language as a conceptual system calls for a cognitive reading, and hence, during the centuries of the purely aesthetic theory of art, language was primarily not allowed into the artwork. There might be there are moments like, let's say, when a figure in a Monet painting is reading a newspaper, and you can see the title of the newspaper, and in that very minor sense, language has been allowed into the work. But in a larger sense, where it really interacts, where language really moves in and kind of stirs things up, that wasn't really seen until Futurism and Dada and Duchamp. I don't feel I've entirely answered your question, but I think I've maybe kind of half answered it. Because when I look at the snow shovel, for example, the snow shovel is called In Advance of a Broken Arm, right? And what is that? I always think of, whenever I see that title, I always think of my grandfather, who when I was a child insisted on shoveling the snow off of his own driveway and twice fell down and broke his back. And so that in that sense, In Advance of the Broken Arm may actually be a kind of a reading of the physical object, but still it seems to me that the bald, plain presence of the physical object as itself is the dominant part of the experience. I guess that's about all I can do with that question. Yes? I'm not quite hearing you toward the end. So if we're going to think of, say, Anastasi's wall on the wall as another type of found object, then it stands without the linguistic addition that Duchamp used to attach in the puns that he put with ready-made, so that Bill has perhaps cleansed the concept of the ready-made a little bit by taking it all the way over into a confrontation with the thing itself, which you can do nothing about or nothing to escape. Oh, yes, hi. Well, I think your remarks are very interesting. I also don't feel that they need any response. Yes. Yeah.
And I think this is a little what I see in these images, that
Well, again, I thank you for your comments. But they stand on their own. I don't feel I need to respond to them. Osvaldo? Yeah.
And the reason why I was trying to listen to the commentary because it's out of the typical issue that people know what was going on. That was striking because I didn't know a lot about English. But I was striking because I don't see things happening like me. This is a world, and this is a representation of the world, but it's stronger than the representation of the world. I think this makes sense. It is more than a
I appreciate your remarks and your expression of the power of the work, which yes, yes, sir. Yes. But he signed the snow shovel too.
What is it? Okay, but now I don't realize the signature on the snow shovel. A shovel as ready as I do the big black R mud.
Yeah.
On the Euro.
Yeah, right. But the reason I chose the snow shovel as the ready-made that I would mention is because I think it's the least susceptible to aesthetic projections of all of his ready-mades. I mean, if one looks, let's say, at the bottle rack, there are traditional aesthetic values such as symmetry and hierarchy involved there, and the same is true about most of the ready-mades, but the snow shovel I see as the most down-to-earth, fundamental, no-nonsense kind of tautologism. It looks, yes, Bill. Yeah.
Let's go back further to New Descending the Staircase. Everyone assumed, as we know, since the moon is such a classical thing, that he's referring to a female moon. It was fairly well assumed.
Yeah.
But there's nothing in there that says it's female.
Yeah.
There's a scene in Superman where there is a moon running down the staircase.
Uh-huh.
And then running up the stairs and running down.
Well, well, I don't know that. Well, it looks like we've got the equipment for an interesting day of discussions here. My time is up, so.